Our next speaker is Dr. John Hennin, professor of history at Morehead State University. His lecture topic is growth or development, economy and dislocation in the Hatfield-McCoy era. Originally from Huntington, West Virginia, Dr. Hennin earned his BA in history from West Virginia University, his MA in history from Marshall University, and returned to West Virginia University for his PhD in history. He is the author of numerous books and articles, including The Americanization of West Virginia, Creating a Modern Historical State. He is the author of The Americanization of West Virginia, Creating a Modern Industrial State, 1916 to 1925, co-editor of West Virginia Historical Essays in the Literature and West Virginia Documents in the History of a Rural Industrial.
Is that correct?
Thank you. And Dr. Hennin won the Morehead State University Distinguished Teacher Award for 2011 and 2012. So without further ado, thank you for coming, John.
Good to see you.
Well, in the last, this microphone's on, can you hear okay? In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to spend some time in, my students kid me because I call it Louisville, I'm an outsider, so spend some time in Louisville, and I love the place, and I was delighted to get the opportunity to come and speak, especially with such a distinguished group of co-panelists. I think the Filson Society, actually two of my favorite Kentucky natural resources are in Louisville with events today. The first being the one we're at, the Filson Historical Society, and the other being Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, which is hosting a festival of the Jefferson County variation of I Love Mountains Day over on Bardstown Road from 3 to 11 tonight.
It's been moved because of potential rain.
Okay, where is it?
The Green Building on Market Street.
Okay, thank you very much. Is that that's right downtown, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Okay.
East
right. Great. Thank you, because I want to go by there later. I also want to say how what a nice opportunity it is to see Altina Waller again. I've known Dr. Waller for a long time. And as Dr. Hutton was saying today, her book, which came out in 1988, I consider still to be one of the three or four formative pieces of Appalachian historiography. And you can once in a while say that a particular piece of reading has changed your life, and this one has certainly changed mine. And just as with Dr. Hutton, it opened up entire new vistas of looking at the way things work to me, and it inspired my graduate career, and it's inspired my career ever since. I encourage everyone, when they get a chance, to read Dr. Waller's book. Also, it's nice. It's finally nice to meet and put a face on Dr. Hutton and Tony Harkins, and I'm sorry that Herb Smith had to leave. I've known Herb for a while. Herb is the kind of guy, and you all could gather that today, I'm sure, that it doesn't matter whether you're having a good day or a bad day. If you run into Herb, it's a better day. He's just a tremendous, tremendous force. And it's too bad he had to leave, and Dr. Waller had to leave too. But anyway, I do have some slides. I'm probably going to deliver my prepared text and then go through the slides, if that's okay, depending on time, except for a few of them. One of them is my prefatory slide, which whenever I speak somewhere, I try to find a way to work Wendell Berry into it. And most of you, probably all of you, are familiar with the great work that Mr. Berry does. For any presentation that deals with the history of anywhere, but specifically the region of Appalachian Kentucky and Appalachian West Virginia that we're focusing on today, is this, I think, very, very profound statement. A part of our inherent ignorance and surely the most formidable encumbrance to those who presume to know the future is our ignorance of the past. We know almost nothing of our history as it was actually lived. We know little of the lives even of our parents. And thank goodness for the Filson Society and the folks who work with the Filson Society for making serious attempts to familiarize ourselves with that past. And with people like Dr. Barry. He'll get mad if you call him Dr. Barry. Don't call him Dr. Barry. I made that mistake once. another true Kentucky resource and a great friend of Appalachian Kentucky. Speaking of ignorance, next slide, the New York Times. Just within the last week or so, published a short article, and actually the article itself was quite good. It was about the attempts of local folks in the Tug and Guyandot Valleys to come up with a model for historical tourism to try to inject some economic vitality into the region based on the Hatfield-McCoy feud. That was a good story. But they also had this part. The last Hatfield-McCoy killing has been traced to the spring of 1947. You got me. But a majority of the family feud violence took place in the late 1880s when dozens of Hatfields and McCoys perished in tit-for-tat skirmishes. No historical grounding in that whatsoever. The feud, which some say, don't you love the ubiquitous some say? Some say pigs can fly. Therefore, we must compromise and assume, well, actually only some of the pigs can fly, not all. But each argument is equally valid. I love that cop-out. Some say, you know. Anyway, some say started over a pig and with a stabbing at a polling place. Part of the pivotal events of the conflict, no doubt. And it formally ended only in 2003 when the families united in the aftermath of the September 11 terror attacks to show that they could overcome their differences. Let's put aside these petty squabbles over our, you know, remote differences and come together to fight the other. We won't be the other anymore. These other people will be the other, all right? Where the New York Times gets this stuff, I have no idea. They used to get their information on a pipeline from Henry Watterson. Oops. He's taken some hits in the last couple days, but that's okay. He can handle it. Let me get started with my prepared comments. Since the appearance of Altina Waller's feud in 1988, Appalachian historiography has expanded on a theme that was suggested in Waller's now classic study, that being the placement of local conflict within a framework of competing modes of national and even global economic development. Without dismissing the particular conditions of any Appalachian place or region, Appalachian historians have challenged the once prevalent notion of what was called Appalachian exceptionalism. That is, the belief that the region was a unique, remote, eccentric, and almost otherworldly cultural place. The fact that Appalachians have been seen at the same time in many historical narratives as inherently savagely violent and also as pastoral passive people is only one indicator of how confused the standard narratives of the mountain regions have been. Understanding the economic contours of the late 19th century community conflict in the Appalachian Mountains must be viewed, I think anyway, as part of the larger post-Civil War growth, frequently violent growth, and let me say here, I'm using an expansive concept of violence, not only physical violence, but violence to culture, violence to spirit, violence to belief, violence to land, okay? So I'm off the hook when I use the word violence, okay? Must be viewed as part of the larger post-Civil War growth, frequently violent growth, of industrial capitalism. From a world systems perspective, the volatile social environment of the era, as Dr. Hutton alluded to today in his presentation, can plausibly be linked to a global political economy that was growing unevenly. Emerging national and international market systems encroached upon and then rapidly destroyed traditional agrarian life and long-standing personalized rituals of law and business transactions. Industrial capitalism, organize the world into distinct spheres. The core of investment centers and centers of commerce and so-called peripheral regions that were to supply raw materials to support the more urban core or metropole, sort of the language of world systems. Within the peripheral regions, such as the Appalachian Mountains, local and regional marketplaces grew, dominated by commercially inclined local modernizers. These centers, referred to by Ronald Lewis, who was my mentor at West Virginia University, he refers to these small commercial centers in the peripheral regions as nodes, N-O-D-E-S. I don't know if he came up with that expression or borrowed it, but it's a great one, I think. These nodes facilitated the transfer of resources and wealth beyond the periphery. You can think of Pikeville and Logan Courthouse in the two counties we're focusing on here as being nodes of commerce facilitation of outside investment. These centers facilitated the transfer of resources and wealth beyond the periphery and imposed rapid structural changes that marginalized traditional local leaders such as Devil Ann's Hatfield. Readers of Feud will easily recognize John Dills and Perry Klein. Let me move to their slide and then I'll lay off the slides for a while. We talked about Dills briefly and Perry Klein more extensively last night. Readers of Feud will easily recognize John Dills and Perry Klein as local modernizers from Pikeville, Kentucky, who embraced a developmental model based on access by external corporate investors. Such readers will also identify H.C. Ragland and James A. Nybert from Logan Courthouse, West Virginia, as local modernizers. A little bit more about them later. Who, as large-scale extractive industry, literally and figuratively steamed into the Guyandotte and Tug Valleys, abandoned the word and handshake business practices or traditional framework of traditional business for the legalistic contractual economy demanded by corporate America. And as Dr. Waller mentioned last night, Devil Ann's Hatfield was not alien to this practice of establishing things legally by contract. He was deeply involved in that. Even before he got into the timber industry and the matter of making sure to file double claims on property that he or his family owned so they'd be protected in the courthouse. So Devil Ann's Hatfield was in many ways a man in between, or striding the traditional practices while being aware of what was coming and wanting to be a part of that, as Altina said last night. As Waller and others have shown, the forcible displacement of traditional culture by the rapid industrial transformation of the valley turned the mixed agricultural and small business communities upside down with violent repercussions. Remember, violence broadly drawn here. At this point, it's prudent to note that some of the conflict in the early phase of the Hatfield-McCoy feud, again, as Dr. Waller mentioned last night, was rooted largely in personal jealousies and grievances, that first phase, okay? And those are the types of feud characteristics, I guess you could say, or conflict characteristics, that tended to grab hold of the public consciousness, all right? In 1941, journalist John Day, who some of you probably remember either probably by reputation, he was a very prominent journalist for both the Courier Journal and the Herald Leader, as well as a distinguished foreign correspondent. In 1941, journalist John Day enumerated the causes of feuding, which are compelling but not particularly helpful if we're trying to understand the systemic rather than individualistic reasons for the conflict. Not to say that in all instances Day should be dismissed, and he certainly articulates the urban conventional wisdom of his time when studying, if you will, mountain culture. Here's the way he put it. He came up with 16 or 17 different reasons for feuding. If there is a synonym for vindictiveness, said Day, it is mountaineer. It is probable that no words can explain exactly and conclusively why the mountain people shoot each other. Many factors have brought on feuds or perpetuated them. Vindictiveness, whiskey, women, hot tempers, preoccupation with guns and gun-toting, a disregard for human life, quarrels over insignificant matters, the Civil War, slow-moving or corrupt legal justice, politics. See, he's on track with some of these. Disputes over land boundaries, and my favorite one, pure cussedness. That's great. I like that one. While each of these may have their own value in some circumstances, they provide little insight into the structural economic reasons that lead to extreme social and class dislocation in times of rapid transition. Such tumult arose in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia in the Hatfield-McCoy era. The resulting conflict between subsistence farmers, says Altina Waller, and you may expand that to say small market farmers, not necessarily subsistence, really, as well as small-scale independent entrepreneurs like Devil Ants, conflict between them and the local allies of distant corporations define the political conflicts of the decade. The exploitation of mountains, then, was not a simple struggle between outsiders and natives, but a complex set of struggles at the local level over control of Appalachia's vast resources. One of the stubborn self-perceptions, and believe me, growing up in West Virginia, I have heard this one or variations of it a gazillion times. One of the stubborn self-perceptions that Appalachian romanticizers cling to is that the resources of the region were stolen by outside corporations. That process of transfer was a lot more complicated than theft. It was legal. And it was legal because powerful people at the state and county levels and less powerful people along for the ride, I'm thinking particularly of the Perry Klein allies among a disenfranchised class of young men during the feud era, less powerful people along for the ride wanted it to happen. They wanted this to happen. It's more accurate to say that the resource wealth of West Virginia and eastern Kentucky was given away rather than that it was stolen. As political columnist Michael Kinsley has often observed, scandal isn't what's illegal, it's what's legal. The legal, if unethical, practices of corporate speculators and their local allies in the mountains won out, as we all know, in the struggle between competing visions because these interests were powerful enough to manufacture, and an expression I like to use, which some people don't like, but we can talk about it later, these interests were powerful enough to manufacture and own the law, law as commodity. Waller and other Appalachian historians such as Ron Eller, John Williams, Dwight Billings, Shauna Scott, Ron Lewis, Alan Banks, the folks who are here today, have documented how law and political economy became thoroughly commodified during the era of industrial transformation. Banks, for example, Alan Banks, another great Kentucky natural resource, he teaches at Eastern Kentucky, studied class formation in the southeastern Kentucky coal fields from 1890 to 1920. It's part of that anthology that Dr. Waller was talking about last night, the article she did with the emphasis on Henry Watterson. It's in the same book, Appalachia in the Making, the Mountain South in the 19th Century, another essential text if you're interested in these things. Studied class formation in southeastern Kentucky coal fields, 1890 to 1920. He showed how large-scale industrial investment could only flourish with the monopolization, as he put it, of the means of production. Get past the Marxist language to what he's actually saying here, okay? With the monopolization of the means of production by a dominant class consisting of landholding, industrial, and or financial interests. As early as 1869, Kentucky Governor Stevenson, you all know him, that's with a V. Strangely enough, there was a Governor Stevenson in West Virginia at precisely the same time. It's very confusing. Kentucky Governor Stevenson had committed his administration to attracting landless workers and capital investment to develop industrial and mineral wealth in the state of Kentucky. As he put it, European capitalists will be favorably impressed with geological surveys showing that Kentucky possesses a greater area of coal of good quality than is contained in any other state in the world. This was standard rhetoric at that time. I'm going to show you a West Virginia governor who said exactly the same thing. And it wasn't Stevenson, it was another guy. The state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth, should develop a comprehensive industrial policy. Laissez-faire? Forget it. Forget it. Government wasn't supposed to leave business alone. It was supposed to promote and facilitate business and protect it from regulators. Okay? The state should develop a comprehensive industrial policy to facilitate immigration, investment, and infrastructural development favorable to extractive industry combined with, quote, generous tax laws for additional incentives. The era witnessed the emergence of a professional and political class devoted to industrial development, a system which personal wealth of a few was presumed to be good for all the interests of the state. What's good for General Motors, et cetera, et cetera. You know. Local elites with a stake in the new system arranged the transfer of resources to outside capitalists, most notoriously by means of the now infamous broad form deed. Many of you have probably heard of that. If not, we can talk about it later. This was a profound development, this legal shift, which, says Banks, may have been little comprehended by the local population. The monopolization of land and resource ownership by new industrial and financial interests was weakening the material basis upon which farmers and other independent commodity producers operated, and was simultaneously strengthening the inflow of outside capital and the outflow of inside human capital, okay, the product of human capital. It generated irrepressible tendencies for the gradual decay of the older way of life. In addition, with the coming of the railroads, workers for the new industries could be drawn, with the aid of government, from surplus populations around the world. Other laborers could be recruited from those mountaineers displaced by the dramatic changes at work in the resource-rich counties. A good example of that is Devil Ants Hatfield. As development came to the valley, land values went up, and Devil Ants was compelled to sell off much of his property in order to pay the higher taxes that accompanied the increased value of the land. As an indicator of how thoroughly the consolidation of eastern Kentucky resources played out within a generation or a generation and a half or two, Ron Eller notes that in the Elkhorn District, Elkhorn Coalfields, this includes Floyd, Knott, Lawrence, Martin, Letcher, and Pike counties, three coal companies control nearly 1 million acres of coal properties, all serviced by the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad. One of these companies was Consolidation Coal, which itself controlled over 1 million acres of coal properties throughout the central Appalachia in this period. Ronald Lewis analyzes, as he puts it, the struggle for dominance between the agrarian and industrial worlds in terms of a philosophical battle between old court and new court, Supreme Court justices on the West Virginia State Supreme Court in the 1890s. These cases that were initiated at the time of the transformation of eastern Kentucky and West Virginia were working their way through the court system, and they came onto the docket while this new court, old court struggle was going on. Not necessarily specific ones, but the same general issues. This conflict, which Lewis tells within the context of the contrasting values of agrarian populist Marmaduke Dent, my favorite name in West Virginia history, he was a judge, Marmaduke Dent, and his colleague and adversary on the court, railroad promoter and owner, Judge Henry Brannan, ended with the triumph of the legal positivism embraced by Brannan over the natural rights common law tradition held by Dent. Now, I'm not a historian of law, but I do know that legal positivism, you can correct me, some of you probably have a better background in law than I do. I know Legal positivism, I think, essentially means a belief in the established precedent with no room for wiggling, no interpretation. Brannon, for instance, said justice has nothing to do with law. It has to do with the established order that facilitates progress. All right? That, in a nutshell, is my understanding of legal positivism. I'm a little more familiar with a broader economic and developmental philosophy called positivism, which was the basis of a lot of the ideology, I think, of these local modernizers. Legal positivism is ideologically attuned to the developmental philosophy, positivism, which formed the philosophical basis for modernizers' vision of order and progress in Brazil, Mexico, England, and the United States, and it took its identity from the theories of French philosopher Auguste Comte, or Comte, I've never known. Comte, okay. I'm going to show you another slide here, I think. Yeah, that's the one I want. There's Henry. And you think, my God, he's gotten tied in with some of his Latin American history courses here. Well, yes, I have. This is the dictator of Mexico from roughly 1874 to 1910 with a two-year interim at the turn of the century, Porfirio Diaz. Diaz was a positivist. Henry Watson was a positivist in terms of analyzing what was needed for order and progress. We'll maybe look at some of the details of that later. According to Latin American historian Bradford Burns, positivism, with its emphasis on material growth and well-being, positivism ideally suited the trends of the latter half of the 19th century. It favored a capitalist mentality regarding private wealth as sacred. Indeed, private accumulation wealth was seen as a sign of progress as well as an instrument of progress. Because of the weaknesses of domestic private institutions, the state had to assume the role of directing progress. Of course, to promote capitalism and to direct progress, according to positivist doctrine, had to maintain order and impose stability. Think back to what Dr. Waller was saying about the intervention by Governor Buckner to right the wrongs that had been inflicted by the Hatfields on the McCoys. His primary goal was to present the image of a stable investment climate in eastern Kentucky. That's what he was about. The state would need to maintain order and impose stability. With its special emphasis on order and progress, that was the national slogan of Brazil at this time, order and progress. Positivism reached the height of its influence between 1880 and 1900. It became almost an official doctrine of the Diaz regime in Mexico, whose principal ministers were known as the cientificos. I had to get that in. It's my favorite word in Spanish. The cientificos, the big idea men, the investors, the efficiency experts, the productivity managers, the engineers who needed to bring Mexico into the modern era, forcibly if necessary. Okay, back to West Virginia. Marmaduke Dent was elected to the West Virginia Supreme Court on the Democratic Populist Fusion ticket of 1892. Not the famous 1896 election, but 1892. Coming from a hardscrabble background, Dent taught school and read for the law in Grafton of Taylor County, West Virginia. This was the county seat and the division headquarters for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. Although Grafton native and novelist Melville Davison Post described the typical West Virginia lawyer of the era as a man with no sense of moral obligation, Dent was atypical. Earning a reputation as a lawyer for the common man. At a time, says Lewis, when most lawyers of the state coveted railroad clients, Duke was intellectually incapable of arguing the case for big business. It didn't mean he was dumb. It meant that he could not philosophically conceive of compromising his principles to argue for a railroad company. He believed that railroads and other corporations existed only with the consent of the public, the early 19th century concept of incorporation, and should be liable for damages in case of accidents or property destruction to local landowners, and should be subject to the jurisdiction of the courts in every state in which they operated, not permitted to take refuge in federal district courts. Dent accepted the early 19th century so-called grant theory that corporations existed only as short-term artificial beings created by public-minded legislators. Jim Wayne's the only one I can think of at the moment, but as a public-minded legislator, political comment. Created by public-minded legislators with powers limited by the state. Corporations are supposed to be limited to state regulation. This is what Dent is saying. He was always prepared to do mortal combat with corporations, and his blood rose to a quick boil when one of the corporate giants stepped on ordinary people. And you probably already have understood that his way of thinking is on the way out. All right, that's on the decline in the court structure. Brannan, on the other hand, favored what was called the entity theory of incorporation, which dismissed the traditional limiting view of corporations and recognized them as permanent and normal, a normal way of doing business, entitled to the same rights and privileges as other individuals and groups. The Citizens United decision of 2010 expanded that idea of individuals as corporations as individuals. It did not create it, but it expanded. Entitled to the same rights and privileges as other individuals and groups. All right? Brannan's positivist approach, Lewis refers to as legal positivism, elevated the corporation as a being in nature, not to be restricted by artificial regulations and abstract notions of justice. The benefits of industrial society would only be fulfilled by establishing legal precedents that, quote, guaranteed employers protection from liability and would eliminate artificial restraints on the liberty to conduct business. Brannan acknowledged, yes, some people in the free market will be ruined by free competition. And he wrote in Transportation Company v. Standard Oil, a railroad accident case, that the dead are found strewn all along the highways of business and commerce. Has it not always been so? In another accident case, he wrote that, this will be a familiar phrase, the law of survival of the fittest has been inexorable. Human intellect, human laws cannot prevent these disasters. He's talking about train wrecks. He's talking about people getting hit by trains, is what he's talking about, or cattle being lost. One of the signifiers of this transition of legal interpretation in West Virginia was a series of cases that before 1880 found in favor of a farmer whose cow had been run over by a train and began to find in favor of the trains after that because the farmer should have kept his cow off of the tracks, all right? That's the old court to the new court, all right? Human intellect cannot prevent these disasters. The dead, this blows my mind. The dead and wounded have no right of action from the working of this imperious law. He's talking about the natural law of the market. What he says is the natural law of the marketplace. By legislation and court decisions that redefine the public interest as that which served corporations first, says Lewis, modernizers like Brannan were making capital secure. The visible hand of legal positivism was starkly present in the valleys of the Tug and Guyandot in the era of the Hatfield-McCoy feud. Altina Waller has identified what I think as, it may be overstating it some, Altina Waller has identified the precise point at which corporate interest officially superseded local interest. That being the restructuring of the county court system by the West Virginia legislature in 1881. During the previous decade, the local modernizing model, embodied by Devil Ants Hatfield, had flourished. Between 1870 in 1881, Devil Lance Hatfield had become a successful businessman and squire, you might say, on the old Virginia model, an employer of many local men, as we saw yesterday, and part of a kinship-centered network of traditional law and reciprocal business arrangements. The revolutionary changes brought on by the new court structure had a profound effect on the political economy in which Devil Lance had prospered, severing the traditional courts, traditional circuit courts, from their close relationship with county courts. It was the county court system through which Devil Lance Hatfield had mobilized his greatest legal power in his neighborhood. After 1881, circuit court judges were elected from a larger geographic sector than previously, which made it unlikely, for example, that rural Logan Countyans like Devil Lance would be represented at the circuit level by like-minded neighbors. Indeed, says Waller, the first two circuit judges under the new system, which vested much more authority in circuit courts than previously, the first two circuit judges under the modified systems were both from Huntington, my hometown. It was a railroad town, right? A city built by Collis P. Huntington, the financier, as a terminus for his railroad. At the same time, the commissioners of the Logan County Court, stepping back a level again, elected in 1881, represented the coming to power of a local political elite, an elite separated from the majority of farmers by residence patterns, wealth, education, and cosmopolitan outlook. The parallels to Dills and Klein were these two guys I mentioned earlier, Raglan and Nybert, in Logan Courthouse, West Virginia. The new commissioners, including James A. Nybert, promoted the developmental model of the commercial town of Logan Courthouse, the local metropole, if you will, or the node, at the expense of the agrarian small market orientation of the Tug Valley region of Logan County. Having lost his political base in the county, along with his kinship-based legal protection, Devil Lance Hatfield and traditionally grounded entrepreneurs everywhere, not only in the Appalachian Mountains, began to lose out to the voracious appetites of national and international capitalist accumulation. Within a few years, Nybert and his partner, H.C. Raglan, who was also the founder of the Logan Banner, which was the newspaper that promoted industrialization in the county, these guys had willingly financed Hatfield's timber operations for years, and they called in all of his debts. They cast their lot with another type of developer, like the L&N Railroad. They called in all of his debts. That's equivalent to saying to some of my students, oh, by the way, all your student loan payments are due tomorrow, all right? This happened to Devil Lance, and it turned his business empire upside down. Somewhat akin to the holder of your mortgage demanding immediate payment. Devil Lance's longstanding practice of turning to the courts for redress in cases of debt or boundary disputes was no longer reliable. The county court had lost its jurisdiction over such cases, and the circuit court was now the instrument of his creditors. Between 1881 and 1900, says Altina Waller, 19 cases were brought against Devil Lance. He lost all of them. Before 1881, he'd been to court I don't know how many times and had never lost a case. That all changed. The timber industry in which he had taken the initiative, this is quoting Dr. Waller again, the timber industry in which he had taken the initiative and had made such striking gains was on the brink of spectacular growth and prosperity, but it was a prosperity that would elude local producers. That's the end of my prepared comments. Listen, look at the how, time? 10 minutes, 15, what, keep going? Well, at this point, are there questions? Let me see if there are questions at this point, and then we can look at the slide. Yes, ma'am, or comments. Thank you. Yeah, he's a crook. Yeah. Well, he's retired now. After spending $4 million on the electoral campaign of one of the West Virginia Supreme Court judges who decided a liability case for Massey Cole a few years ago. But go ahead. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Massey is massive, you know. Oh, sure. All these cases have an impact wherever coal is produced, wherever extractive resources are produced. I'm not sure. As far as coal, yeah. But what Massey has done historically and what other major corporations have done is oftentimes they will buy up the smaller companies that have gone into the court system or are in trouble, can't make enough money to pay their moral obligation to their retirees because they had the good fortune to be in the United Mine Workers 30 years ago. And when these small companies can't pay their debts anymore, a company like Massey will move in and buy them out and then declare them bankrupt. And therefore, they're not obligated to those debts anymore. Massey does this. Patriot Coal, which I don't even know where they're based, they're going through this in West Virginia right now. St. Louis, maybe. Do you have any idea where but they're all over the place. The trials in St. Louis. They're currently going through litigation filed by the United Mine Workers in the name of its retirees because the company is attempting to suspend payments on their retirement. So if their retirement payments are taken away through bankruptcy, they'll get about 50%, maybe less, of their retirement, and it won't be paid for by any corporate entity. It'll be paid for by us through a federal program. This is the business model. This is the business model. It was begun, who knows when, probably long before the period we're talking about here, but it became much more sophisticated and much more, it's now legal. See, it is legal. It is the law. That's why I call it the ownership of the law. But Massey's everywhere. They're everywhere. Yes?
You were talking about the limit of damages for railroads.
A shift in...
The 1891 Constitution, which is in effect now in Kentucky, will not allow a capped verdict. Whatever the proof shows, there's always a move on to say, well, you ought to cap this one at this.
Oh, a liability, a damage decision?
It is forbidden by the current Kentucky Constitution because they were paying $10 for top line steers and everything else.
Yeah. The railroads were paying $10. Yeah.
Without that, we'd say that for a cow, it's so much for a horse, so much for a person.
It applied to people, too.
But
yeah, sure.
In 1891, sort of a populist movement that would not be a limitation on damages.
Yeah. Let me show you, this is interesting, let me show you a West Virginia populist in just a second. But I wanted to point out that this is the language here. All citizens of a republic should receive the same training so that their ideals and methods may be harmonized and the national identity intensified. Diaz was talking about the harmonization and the standardization of education to the degree that it's going to be accessible to people in Mexico. Henry Watterson, as I put it here anyway, this is subject to debate, of course, had a similar positive perspective, advertising Eastern Kentucky as the most inviting field for the speculator, the investor, the manufacturer, the railroad builder that the whole county involves. He agreed with the New York Times. As a matter of fact, he probably sent this to the New York Times. I don't know. Which claimed that the new railroads will serve as missionaries to transform gradually the character of the secluded villages. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
I remember I was surprised a number of years ago reading Seedling and Woodward's Strange Career of Jim Crow.
Strange Career of Jim Crow. Uh-huh.
In which he pointed out that Tom Watson, before he became a fearless racist, was a supporter of blacks and white farmers getting together against the common enemy.
Yeah, he was a populist who tried to break down the racial barriers that were separating small farmers.
The ruling class of the South, the Bourbons, were able to
manipulate the Negro to vote Republican against their best interest. But there was a chance at one time that black and white farmers could, you know, go against their common enemies. Too bad it didn't work out.
Actually, I would disagree a little bit. In the 1880s, to the degree that blacks still had any representation in the South, it was through the Republican Party. But that was the party that was being fairly rapid. This is the redemption period that Dr. Hutton was talking about. But nonetheless, yeah, Watson was an agrarian radical, agrarian reformer. Now, whether or not he was virulently racist while he was an agrarian reformer and didn't change, or whether he was not racist and then did change, who knows? But certainly politically, he saw the advantages and the necessity. If small farmers were going to get equity in that system, they had to be aligned black and white. By the early 1900s, late 1890s, he was actually the populist candidate for vice president, 1896, on the populist ticket. But by 1900, he had absorbed the more dominant ideology of white supremacy and racial segregation and became one of the leading race baiters in a position of power. People always debate that, and I think in many cases that is true. I emphasize class more in my studies.
The Reagan Democrats, you know, they have more in common actually with blacks than they do with the plutocrats.
Yeah. Yeah, except they've all voted for Reagan. Plutocrats and... No, I know what you mean. It's one of those arguments that is irresolvable, but it's a fascinating argument, the relative power of race, class, and where they meet and where they don't.
The classic biography on Tom Watson is Agrarian Rebel.
It's by Woodward. Oh. Yeah, Vance Woodward. Vance Woodward? T. Vance Woodward, yeah, thanks. T. Van Woodward, thank you. Thank you, V-A-N-N, right. This is a West Virginia... Now, C. Van Woodward. You're right. Thank you. This is the guy who was Devil Anse's ally when it was all hitting the fan in post-1881. This is E. Willis Wilson. Altina mentioned him last night. He was the last of what you can call the agrarian populist governors of West Virginia for the next six or eight governors. He was supplanted in 1890. By a positivist governor, a former corporate lawyer named A.B. Fleming. Anyway, he was a friend of Devil Anse and the agrarian system that was represented prior to the intervention of mass railroad construction and that type of thing. Watchdog of railroads and corporations, ally of Devil Anse Hatfield, he advocated the public ownership of railroads and the regulation of industrial pollution in the streams. He was somewhat ahead of his time. Well, actually, he was not. That was traditional populist mainstream stuff then. Early in his term, if we've got a few minutes, I'm going to get into this document a little bit. Early in his term, I know it was 1884, a remarkable document was issued by a special commission that I'm assuming Wilson appointed. I'm not certain about that. It's called the West Virginia Tax Commission. It was designed to, I guess, modernize the tax code in the state or something like that. The minority report is what makes for fascinating reading. It included this: a state is unprosperous when the wealth is being absorbed by a few individuals. A state is doubly unprosperous when the property is rapidly passing from her present population of home people into the hands of non-residents. This is 1884, but remember, this is the minority view on the position. The report asks the reader to speculate, to look into the future if current practices continue. First, let me say this. People are apt to be deceived by appearances. A railroad may be constructed, mines may be constructed, a temporary and fugitive population may gather in rude shanties about the mine. You're talking about the international proletariat coming to the mining regions. Stores may be built, and there may be for a while a deceptive appearance of development. But if the entire enterprise is owned by non-residents, if all the profits belong to persons who reside abroad, if those who are permanently identified with the locality do not participate in the harvest, the state is going backwards. When we run our memory back and contemplate the changes in this state during the past 20 years, we seem authorized to declare that if the same practices be continued 20 years longer, West Virginia will be grievously injured, if not irretrievably ruined. The treasures untouched in 1865 have been considerably exhausted. Vast private fortunes have been accumulated, but not by those who are our permanent citizens. Please indulge me, one more extended quote. The non-resident capital is represented in almost every village, the nodes of commerce, by an agent. This agent is generally a lawyer of the best capacity. And these agents have a private interest far greater than their concern for the public welfare. Noam Chomsky sometimes asks a great question. Where along the line did private vice become associated with public good? Besides this, the people who have been educated to believe that our immediate development must be obtained at any cost and regardless of sacrifice. The public mind has become saturated with an idea that progress means one railroad where there is no railroad, and two railroads where there is only one. And he who would raise a voice against this sacrifice of our local wealth is shut out from all participation in public affairs, excluded from accustomed avenues to the public ear. Whatever argument will cajole the people into advancing the money-making schemes of individuals is published in the papers and advocated by men employed to manufacture public opinion, while every fact calculated to acquaint the people with the true state of affairs is carefully suppressed by influential journals and by those who are recognized as successful politicians. That was the Minority Report. Wilson was succeeded in a really fascinating electoral process. This took over a year to determine who the successor to Wilson was. There were four different candidates who claimed to have been elected governor. And at one point, Wilson allegedly barricaded himself inside the governor's office and refused to come out because the state legislature had decided by two votes that this man had actually won the election, A.B. Fleming, who Ron Lewis would describe as an ironhead industrialist. You mentioned the Bourbon agrarians. You had the Bourbon agrarians, the populist agrarians, and the ironhead industrialists. In other words, the progenitors of, as the West Virginia Tax Commission put it, emissaries of injurious schemes. All right? He was a positive, as he said, just like Stephen said, no other state in the Union today possesses such cheap and abundant raw materials or offers such conspicuous opportunities for safe and profitable investment of capital. Okay. Any other questions, comments? I don't mean to depress people. Go ahead, Mr. Hutton, Dr. Hutton.
How would you, I know there's sort of a mixed pickle, but how would you categorize the so-called progressive governors, Hatfield and Glasgow? They're sort of, when it gets around to the Cold Wars, they do one thing one day and something else.
Yeah. They did, but Henry D. Hatfield was elected governor of West Virginia in 1909, I think. No, 1912. He succeeded Glasscock, who'd been elected in 1908. And he was a grandson of Devil Anse Hatfield. He was trained as a medical doctor. He practiced as a physician for several coal companies at a very early age, 16 or 18. And he did, in many ways, embody this reform movement known as progressivism in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Progressivism was designed largely to mediate class conflict, to avoid potential for class war between workers and industrialists. All right? Progressives saw themselves as in the middle and being completely disinterested and rational observers and having everybody's best interest in mind and that type of thing. Well, I have a great deal of respect for many of the progressives, although many progressives in the South also rationalized voter restrictions because they believed only intelligent, educated, efficient people should run government. And, of course, no black people can do that, or no white farmers either, for that matter. So those were progressive reforms at that time. But Hatfield, to get back to your question, Hatfield mediated a resolution between a bitter conflict. I mean, you talk about violence. I mean, the Hatfield-McCoy feud in terms of actual physical violence was a pebble compared to a landslide for the Cabin Creek strike of 1912 and 1913. Hatfield saw this as being damaging to the interests of the state, damaging to the interests of the workers, and damaging to the interests of the corporations. So he mediated a kind of half-baked settlement, which restricted some of the practices of the coal companies and the railroads, but refused to recognize the United Mine Workers, which is what the whole strike had been about. So to answer your question, I put him down, not necessarily the iron-headed industrialist, not necessarily in the pure positivist mode of Fleming, but a little more in a little broader concept of what the public interest was, I think. A perfect case study of progressivism. Now, Governor Glasscock, I think, was a little more maybe out of the bourbon. I don't know. I can't get into him. I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but old Mother Jones, the great labor organizer, had a lot of set-tos with Hatfield and Hancock and several West Virginia governors, Glasscock, and she always called Glasscock Governor Crystal Peter. The historical record. All right, I didn't make it up. So, time? Any other questions? Like my mentor used to say, I don't want to hold you artificially, but if we have any more comments or questions. Okay, we'll suspend it for now then and get ready for Mr. Harkins. Thank you.